Hi, this is Joe Levine with a podcast introduction for teachers to Chapter 6, Humans in the Biosphere. The subject matter of this chapter presents several challenges that you can turn into teaching opportunities. The first challenge is not presenting human ecology as a series of disasters that prove humanity is making a mess of things. I really advise you not to use this going to hell in a handbasket approach. Why? Because it turns students off instead of empowering them. Kids end up thinking, what's the use of learning this stuff? The environment's a mess and there's nothing anyone can do about it. But the opposite, or Pollyanna approach, claiming that we don't have any environmental problems, isn't scientifically accurate and not good for the future of humanity either. So what's a teacher to do? Here's our approach. We've set up the chapter to present what is often bad news in a context that helps teach both the content and the value of ecological science. We start by making clear that humans, like all organisms, affect environments in which we live. There's no way to avoid that. In collecting nutrients and energy we need, we have unavoidable effects on our surroundings. We are no different from any other living things in that regard. The way that humans are different is that we can recognize the effects we have on our environment. We can then evaluate the changes we've caused and decide whether or not we want to do something about them. So we present the following multi-step scenario. First, human activity has an effect on the environment that may or may not be desirable and that may or may not have been predictable in advance. Second, using tools and methods of science, scientists recognize that impact. Third, researchers gather data to identify the precise causes of the environmental impact. Fourth, researchers attempt to understand the impact and describe its effects by forming and testing hypotheses. Fifth, if human activity is having negative effects on the environment, and if hypotheses about the causes of those effects are supported by data, scientists try to work with economists and policymakers to figure out a way to change the impact of our activities. How is this approach different? Well, it emphasizes that science is a rational process that can provide useful information to improve the human condition. That process isn't perfect, and it sure isn't infallible. Science doesn't have all the answers. In global ecology in particular, research often raises as many questions as it answers. And biologists by themselves usually don't have the economic and political knowledge necessary to propose solutions that work in the real world. But science, properly applied, can be an invaluable tool to decision makers. In this chapter, we present three different stories as examples of this approach to environmental challenges. Each situation is at a different stage in the process we've just described. The ozone story is a great example. First, researchers noticed ozone holes and described their dangerous effects on human health and the environment. Other researchers identified the cause of ozone depletion as human release of chlorofluorocarbons, or CFCs, into the atmosphere. Scientists, politicians, and the business community began a dialogue. The first result was the agreement known as the Montreal Protocol, which called for reduction in the production and use of CFCs worldwide. Then, the United States and other CFC producers independently passed laws aiming at achieving those goals. As the graph in the Analyzing Data feature on page 158 shows, those agreements have succeeded in lowering the concentration of CFCs in the atmosphere. And the most recent data on ozone holes show that they seem to be beginning to shrink. So, a rational, scientific approach to environmental problems can work. The story about fisheries management, presented on page 147, describes a situation in which we are roughly halfway through the stages described for the ozone story. And the introduction to global warming and climate change, presented on page 159, is a good example of how things can get bogged down in the early stages. But there's still hope that we can make further progress. There's another important concept to get across in this chapter, the vital connection between ecology and economics. I mentioned at the beginning of the chapter that ecology and economics are both based on the same Greek root, oikos, which means house. But the connections between ecology and economics don't stop there. Economic development depends on activities such as farming and mining that interact with the environment. Yet, economists and ecologists are often quite at odds with each other. And the conflict is heating up. In some parts of our country today, even teaching about issues like global warming is a hot political issue. And that's a dangerous situation. Why? Well, take renewable resources such as clean air, clean, drinkable fresh water, and fertile soil that supports agriculture. These resources don't appear by magic. Where is Harry Potter when you really need him? They're produced by ecosystem activities of the sorts we've learned about in the first three chapters of this unit. So these resources may, in fact, be renewable, or they may not be, depending on how we treat the ecosystems whose processes renew them. If we damage ecosystems too much, we can lose the resources they provide. Too much clear-cutting of forests in watersheds, for example, can harm local water supplies. Now, this may seem obvious to anyone who understands ecosystems. So why should these problems ever arise? Because resources like clean air and water are so basic and have always been so plentiful and so readily available that many people take them for granted and assume that they will always be available. Economists in particular traditionally think this way. Air and water have always been free, so economists attach little economic value to them. And for that reason, most business models assume that it isn't worth spending money to protect those resources. How can ecologists try to bridge this difference in worldview? One way is by trying to talk to economists in their own language. That's why ecologists now refer to renewable resources as ecosystem goods and services. This language emphasizes two things. First, that resources such as air and water do have economic value. Second, that the availability of these resources depends on healthy ecosystems. Of course, when economists hear this language, they immediately ask, well, how much are these so-called goods and services actually worth? That's why, back in 1997, an international team of economists and environmental scientists tried to put a dollar amount on the ecosystem goods and services used by human society worldwide. What was their estimate? About $33 trillion or more each year. Now, $33 trillion is a number so large that it doesn't make any sense to most of us. So consider this. That amount is nearly twice the combined annual gross national product, or GNP, of all countries in the world. In other words, if we were to try to replace these so-called free ecosystem goods and services by somehow making them ourselves, we would need to raise the global GNP by at least $33 trillion. So remember, ecology is all about connections among living systems. One of the most important messages you can give your students is that these connections include human societies and the one we live in particular.